book of Romans is the most extensive explanation of the gospel in the Bible. After an introduction in Romans chapter 1, verses 1 through 17, it starts right where we are. We are condemned. We stand before God rightly condemned because we have sinned against Him. And then after explaining condemnation to us and all the way through chapter 3, verse 20, it moves into a section on justification. And it says that there is a way to be saved from this condemnation that we stand in our natural condition. There is salvation. There is justification, and it is by grace, and it is through faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. And so he explains justification in chapters from chapter 3, verse 21, all the way through the end of chapter 5. And then in chapter 6, he moves into a section on sanctification. And sanctification has to do with holy living. It has to do with putting to death this old sinful nature within us and living righteously. And so, we are in a section now that deals with the subject of sanctification. Now, in getting to this section on sanctification, the book of Romans has had a lot to say about the law. Romans 3:28 says, "For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from observing the law." And Romans 6:14 says, "You are not under law, but under grace." And Romans 7:6 says, "We have been released from the law." Now, statements like these can lead to misunderstandings about the law. For instance, if we are justified by faith apart from observing the law, and if we are not under law but under grace, and if we have been released from the law, it might be that someone would get the idea that the law is evil, that the law is sinful, that the law is our problem. Is the law evil? Is the law sinful? That is the question that Romans 7 through 12 is concerned with. And so the first thing that Romans 7 through 12 does is it tells us that the law is not evil, but it defines what sin is. That is, you know what the law does. Romans 7:7 says, "What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. Indeed, I would not have known what sin was except through the law. For I would have not known what it was to covet if the law had not said, 'Do not covet.'" Do you know what sin is? Then read the Ten Commandments. It is in the Ten Commandments that sin is defined. "For sin is any lack of conformity to or transgression of the law of God." In Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, he gives a detailed exposition of the Ten Commandments that is well worth reading. And I want to draw from that section to review for you what sin is. The first commandment says, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." The purpose of this commandment, says Calvin, is that the Lord wills alone to be preeminent among His people and to exercise complete authority over them. "It is not necessary," writes John R. Stott, "to worship the sun or the moon and the stars to break this law. We break it whenever we give to something or someone other than God Himself the first place in our thoughts and our affections. It may be some engrossing sport. It may be some absorbing hobby or selfish ambition. Or it may be some other person that we idolize. We may worship a god of gold and silver in the form of safe investments and a healthy bank balance, or a god of wood and stone in the form of property and possessions. Sin is fundamentally the exaltation of self at the expense of God. To keep the first commandment perfectly, which is the only way rightly to keep this or any of the commandments, is, as Jesus taught, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. It means giving Him first place in everything, in all of our loves, in all of our goals, in all of our actions. It means using all that we have and all that we are in His service. No one has ever kept this command perfectly except Jesus Christ. The second commandment says, "You shall not make yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or in the earth beneath or in the waters which are under the earth. You shall not adore or worship them." The purpose of this commandment, writes Calvin, is that he does not will that his lawful worship should be profaned by superstitious rites. The first commandment dealt with the object of our worship, forbidding the worship of any false god. The second commandment deals with the nature of our worship, forbidding us to worship even the true God in an unworthy manner. The third commandment says, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain." In connection with this commandment, Calvin wrote that we must diligently observe three points. First, whatever our mind conceives of God, whatever our tongue utters, should savor of His excellence, match the loftiness of His sacred name, and lastly, serve to glorify His greatness. Secondly, we should not rashly or perversely abuse His holy word and worshipful mysteries, either for the sake of our own ambition or greed or amusement, but as they bear the dignity of His name imprinted upon them, they should ever be honored and prized among us. Finally, we should not defame or detract from His works. As miserable men are wont abusively to cry out against Him, but whatever we recognize as done by Him, we should speak of with praise of His wisdom, of His righteousness and goodness. That is what it means to hallow God's name. The fourth commandment says, "Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but He rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the seventh day, the Sabbath day, and made it holy." According to Calvin, keeping this commandment consists in three things. First, under the repose of the seventh day, the heavenly lawgiver meant to represent to the people of Israel spiritual rest, in which believers ought to lay aside their own works to allow God to work in them. Secondly, he meant that there was to be a stated day for them to assemble, to hear the law and perform the rites, or at least to devote it particularly to meditation upon His works, and thus through this remembrance to be trained in piety. Thirdly, he resolved to give a day of rest to servants and those who are under the authority of others, in order that they should have some respite from toil. The fifth commandment says, "Honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you." According to Calvin, the sum of this commandment is that we should look up to those whom God has placed over us and should treat them with honor, obedience, and gratefulness. It follows from this that we are forbidden to detract from their dignity either by contempt, by stubbornness, or by ungratefulness. The sixth commandment says, "You shall not kill." Calvin states that all violence, injury, and any harmful thing at all that may injure our neighbor's body are forbidden to us in this commandment. The seventh commandment says, "You shall not commit adultery." This commandment requires chastity before marriage and faithfulness after marriage. Jesus commented on this commandment and made its application even broader when he said, "You have heard that it was said, 'Do not commit adultery,' but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." John Stott has written on this commandment, "It includes flirting, experimenting, and solitary sexual experience. It also includes all sexual perversions. For although men and women are not responsible for a perverted instinct, they are responsible for its indulgence. It includes selfish demands in wedlock and many, if not all, divorces. It includes the deliberate reading of pornographic literature and giving in to impure fantasies. The commandment embraces every abuse of a sacred and beautiful gift of God. The eighth commandment says, "You shall not steal." According to Calvin, there are many ways to steal. One consists in violence when another's goods are stolen by force and unrestrained brigandage. A second kind consists in malicious deceit when they are carried off through fraud. Another lies in a more concealed craftiness when a man's goods are snatched from him by seemingly legal means. Still another lies in flatteries when one is cheated of his goods under the pretense of a gift. But let us not stop too long to recount the kinds of theft. Let us remember that all those arts whereby we acquire the possessions and money of our neighbors, when such devices depart from sincere affection to a desire to cheat or in some manner to harm, are to be considered as theft. The ninth commandment says, "You shall not be a false witness against your neighbor." The purpose of this commandment, says Calvin, is, since God, who is truth, abhors a lie, we must practice truth without deceit toward one another. To sum up then, let us not malign anyone with slanders or false charges, nor harm his substance by falsehood. In short, injure him by unbridled evil, speaking, and impudence. To this prohibition, the command is linked that we should faithfully help everyone as much as we can in affirming the truth in order to protect the integrity of his name and possessions. Well, the 10th commandment says, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor." James Montgomery Boyce writes about the 10th commandment that it is in some ways the most revealing and the most devastating of all, for it deals explicitly with the inward and not merely the outward nature of the law. Covetousness is an internal attitude which may or may not express itself in an outwardly acquisitive act. Covetousness is a root sin. For when it is exercised fully, it causes a breach of each of the other commandments. Well, there you have it. The law defines what sin is. We know what sin is because of God's law. Because the law defines what sin is no reason to say that the law is evil any more than to say that a dictionary is evil because it defines what words mean. The second thing that's section says to us is, the law is not evil, but sin in me provokes me to break it. This is what happens. Our sinful hearts are provoked by the commandments to break them. Paul explains it this way in Romans 7:8. But sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, produced in me every kind of covetous desire. What Paul is saying is that the Ten Commandments prohibits coveting. But knowing that coveting was prohibited, that was the very thing that his heart became full of. Covetousness. St. Augustine, in his Confessions, tells of a time in his youth when he and a band of his friends went into a neighbor's yard at night to steal pears. I like this story because it reminds me of the time that I went into my neighbor's yard in the middle of the day and stole pears. And I got caught. But they shook the neighbor's tree, knocking down a large quantity of pears, and then carried them off, eating a few but throwing most of them to some pigs. Why did Augustine steal the pears? With characteristic thoroughness, this great medieval theologian analyzes that for many pages. What was it, the beauty of the pears? They were beautiful, it is true, since they were a part of God's creation, but that was not why He stole them. He had others of even greater beauty at home. Was He hungry and needed something to eat? That was not the reason either. Did He want to be approved by the others? That was part of the reason, He says, but it does not explain why the others, like Himself, should have given approval for such a wrong act. Why should stealing be praiseworthy? At last, Augustine gets to the real reason, saying, "I only picked them so that I might steal. I loved nothing in it except the thieving." Men are like that. We sin because we love sinning. But in addition to that, we are rebels. We tend to want to do the very thing that we are prohibited from doing. When we are prohibited from doing something, our minds focus upon that thing, and our hearts desire all the more to do that very thing. James Montgomery Boyce told a story about a grade school experience that he had one spring when Jim Boyce was in the sixth grade. His grade school principal came into the classroom one day just before they were about to be released to go home for lunch. He said that he had heard that some of the students had been bringing firecrackers to school, and he wanted to say that this was definitely not allowed. If any of his students even brought a firecracker into school, even if they did not set it off, he would expel them immediately. Well, Jim Boyce didn't own any firecrackers. He had not even been thinking about firecrackers before the principal came in to talk about firecrackers. But when he got to thinking about firecrackers, he remembered one of his friends who had some firecrackers. And so on the way home from school, a friend, and he went by this other friend's house, picked up some firecrackers and returned to school with them 45 minutes later. They went into the cloakroom, invited another friend to go in with them. They lit the fuse and exploded a firecracker in that old public school building with high ceilings and marble floors and hard plaster walls. And the principal was in that classroom before those boys had staggered out of that cloakroom, clouded with blue smoke and strewn with tiny bits of white paper. The principal was as stunned as they were, though differently. He kept saying over and over again, after they had been sent home and had come back to his office with their parents, "I had just made the announcement. I had just told them not to bring any firecrackers into the school. I just can't believe it." Well, that's what the law does. It provokes the wickedness that is in us. In doing so, it shows us that sin is sin. Sin is a violation of God's law. But that does not make God's law evil. It shows us how strong sin is. And it must be very strong if it can use even God's good law for such ends. There's another thing that the law does that is not evil. The law is not evil, but it exposes sin in us. Romans 7, 9 through 11 is Paul's personal testimony that this is what the law does. "I once was alive apart from the law. But when the commandment came, sin came alive and I died. The very commandment that promised life proved to be death to me. For sin, seizing an opportunity through the commandment, deceived me and through it killed me." What does that mean? In what sense was Paul alive apart from the law once? Was he ever without knowledge of the law? And in what sense was he put to death? There was a time in his life when Paul thought that he was in good standing before God. God had told him what to do and he had done it. If ever there was anyone who had pleased God, then surely it was himself, thought Paul. He was alive in the sense that he had never been put to death as a result of a confrontation with the law of God. But then the commandment came. That is, the commandment came home to him. The lights turned on in his head. He had known it before. If he is still referring to covetousness at this point, and he may very well be, he had known not to covet from his youth, but now he began to understand the commandment And with this understanding, his self-righteousness and self-confidence began to melt away. The words he uses are, "I died." When the law finally began to get through to him to do its proper work, he saw, number one, that he was guilty of having broken it. And number two, that his nature was such that instead of wanting to keep it from the point of this new insight forward, he actually wanted to break it. Instead of driving sin out, the law awakened sin within him. He saw how hopeless his sinful condition was. Is the law sin because it defines what sin is? Is the law sin because sin inside of me provokes me to break it? Is the law sin because it exposes the sin in me? Certainly not. The law is holy. And the law and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. One thing the law does for us is it brings us to the end of ourselves, just like it did for the Apostle Paul. The law exposes us as the sinners that we are. This is a good thing, because when we are exposed as sinners, when we realize how hopeless our condition is, then we are ready to turn to Jesus Christ for salvation. Dr. John Gerstner, a former professor of church history at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary and mentor to R.C. Sproul, was preaching on Romans and expounding the law one time. He was stripping away the veil on human wickedness. After the service, a woman approached him. She was holding up her hand with her index finger and her thumb about a half an inch apart, about like that. And she said to Dr. Gerstner, "You make me feel about this big." And Gerstner replied, "Oh, but madam, that's too big. That's much too big. Don't you know that much self-righteousness will take you to hell?" And he was right. The law was given to drive out all self-righteousness so that we might embrace Jesus Christ as our only Savior. Has the law done that for you? Has the law so exposed the sin in your life that you realize that you are wretched, that you are helpless and a hopeless person? If it has, then praise God. You are just the person that Jesus is ready to save. So flee to Him and be set free from the condemnation of the law. With that, we'll sing our final hymn of the day. And it is hymn number 528. We're going to sing stanzas 1 and 4 of "My Faith Looks Up to Thee."